Welcome to another 2023 episode of It's Not Brain Surgery, the AANS Practice and Business Management Podcast. I'm your host today, Paul Camerata, and it is really my honor to be able to interview Kiara Haraher. Dr. Haraher is going to talk to us about a Privademic Model, One Surgeon's Perspective. This is another podcast in our continuing series this month on practice management concepts. What are they? And why should you care? Dr. Haraher is a clinical professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University. She received her medical degree from McMaster University in Hamilton, Canada, and her MPH from Harvard. She completed then her neurosurgery residency at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Canada, fellowships in vascular surgery and cyberknife radiosurgery at Stanford. She's currently the chief of neurosurgery at Dominican Hospital in Santa Cruz, and she leads the Stanford Neurosurgery Outreach Clinic. She's got a general neurosurgery practice, predominantly treating patients with brain tumors, degenerative spine conditions, and carotid stenosis. And she's very active in her community, regularly speaks at healthcare events and educational centers for primary care physicians. She's also very active in organized neurosurgery. She is the treasurer since 2020 of the California Association of Neurological Surgeons, CANS. She'll be the president-elect next year, formed the finance committee in CANS, and also is very active in the Western Neurosurgical Society, was the CME chair, program chair, and invited speaker at the Ethics Symposium. She's on the Practice Management Committee and Ethics Committee, the AANS, and Vice Chair of Content Communications and Public Relations on the CNS-AANS Washington Committee. She's a recent member of the Neurosurgical Society of America and a delegate for CANS on the CSNS. She's been very active in the Congress, as you heard, at the AANS, the Washington Committee, and continues to forge new vistas in the outreach at Stanford University. Dr. Haraher, welcome to the AANS podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul.
And sorry, do you mind if I call you just Kiara instead of Dr.
Haraher? Yeah, that would be great.
Thank you. Can you describe for us your practice setting? Would you identify it as a private practice or academic or privademic or somewhere in the middle?
Yes, it's fairly unique. Definitely for Stanford, it's unique. So I have a general neurosurgery practice that is 45 minutes south of Stanford Hospital in a beautiful little seaside town called Santa Cruz, California.
And there's tough living in Santa Cruz. Yeah,
I know. And it's, you know, there's a long convoluted story about how I ended up here, but I had come to Stanford to do my fellowship. I had every intention of going back to Canada, where I am from, to practice there. And interestingly, on a bike ride across Canada, the year before, we had met some people from Santa Cruz who became close friends of ours, who were instrumental in us coming to California. And right before I was about to go home, my chair at the time, Dr. Steinberg, asked me if I would ever consider staying, and that Stanford was trying to create some ties further south in some community hospitals that really needed help with neurosurgery, one of which was Dominican Hospital in Santa Cruz. And would I ever consider staying? And I thought, wow, I go to Santa Cruz almost every weekend to visit my friends and go riding, and that's a pretty nice place. I don't know if I can turn that up. So, so we came down, and my husband and I at the time, and checked it out. And as you know, from being a Stanford alumni, it's absolutely beautiful down here, especially the outdoors. And it's a really nice community. I was interviewed by the head of the hospital, president, who was female, as well as the head of business operations, who was female. And they were very, very excited to have possibly a female neurosurgeon down in this community. They hadn't had a stable neurosurgeon in many years. There'd been a lot of turnover. And so they were really looking to grow that program. And so I started off very small as the only one here, doing general neurosurgery, which is a bit of a difference from what I had been trained. I had done open vascular and primarily cranial work. So I always say my first year here was kind of like a mini spine fellowship, which was fine. I mean, I always loved all of neurosurgery, so I was fine to do general neurosurgery. I do love general neurosurgery, actually. Sure. And so it sort of started out small, but then I've added now two surgeons. physicians who, you know, again, have, they're not full-time, but they have some other roles within Stanford who are down here as well. And, you know, we're looking to, even grow further. There's, as we talk about often at CSNS, there's a private practice has really changed. A lot of people have joined groups, employed models, especially here in California. There's a lot of big groups like Kaiser and Palo Alto Medical Foundation, Dignity Health. And so Stanford now has partnered with Dignity Health through this contract with Dominican Hospital. Yeah. And there's possibilities for maybe some other partnerships further down south as well, because these communities really don't want, you know, I think that there's a misconception. I am Stanford employed. So just to be clear, Stanford,
right,
my paycheck, I am billed through Stanford. Everything is through Stanford. But I really do, I really am a member of the medical staff and the community in Santa Cruz and even south in Watsonville. And so these communities don't always want to send all their patients to what we call the big house. There's actually especially bread and butter general neurosurgery, people want to stay in their community unless you can. If they say to me, doc, you know, do you have the same equipment? Do you have staff that are well-trained to do this craniotomy or this back fusion? I say, yeah, I mean, I can do the same thing here. I have a med-surg floor that's very trained in taking care of spine patients and brain tumors. My ICU is good enough for what I do. And I think to make the kind of model I have work, you have to work within the limits of what that hospital can provide and do what you can do very well, but not try to reach outside of that and push the boundaries too much. Know when you need to sort of send things to the big house, because just the level of care that might be needed, your little hospital may not be able to do. But there's a lot that these community hospitals can actually do for neurosurgery and provide those services. So that's kind of been the model. So I sort of work in a way like a private practice doctor. I mean, the doctors that refer to me are private practice. I work within different health groups. I see some Kaiser patients. I see some Palo Alto Medical Foundation patients from employed settings. The way it was set up with the contracting was really unique. So I am kind of able to see a lot of different types of patients and provide that service to the community, especially the call. And that's, I think, what's come up in some of the discussions, what's unique about my model from a point of view of how you want to set up your practice, is I take call at the hospital, but unlike, you know, some academic centers, I actually get paid for call because, there's pros and cons to that. Obviously I don't have residents and, people like that are going to be helping me, but, it is a way, depending on how you want to set up your practice, to supplement your income significantly, working in a community hospital taking call. So again, it's not a normal setup for Stanford. You kind of have to negotiate your own little way of figuring out how you're going to make it all work with, your clinical responsibilities. I teach at the medical school. I teach first and second medical students, history of, principles of surgery or principles of medicine. So history and physical. I did an exam yesterday. Cool. On cardiovascular, cardiovascular, watching them do their clinical skills for cardiovascular. And it's fun to do that stuff with medical students. My model's unique. It's I'm very much involved in the faculty at Stanford. I'm not sort of out in the middle of nowhere, kind of with some affiliate or adjunct, appointment. Yeah. I'm very much in the faculty, but part of that might be geography because I'm not that far away. Like I can go up there for grand rounds and that sort of thing. And
well, it's interesting because, you're described as the head of outreach, and in most large practices, even academic or private, if you start talking about outreach, that generally means you're going and doing a clinic like out 40 miles away and sending everything back to the mother house. And you're not doing that.
No, communities don't like that.
Yeah.
And I think that model has been tried and in other settings in this area, from other big institutions, and it doesn't work.
Has there been any thought? So, I mean, sending all of the really complex stuff, that you don't have the equipment or the backup, et cetera, for to the mothership is understandable, but then the trainees at the mothership are seeing all that incredibly highly technical stuff. Has there been any thought to maybe down the road, maybe using this site as an educational site?
Yes, and it has come up. They've actually sort of done that already at Stanford with they have some residents do a rotation at Kaiser, which is a different model, obviously, than it's not an academic model. And the residents love that rotation. And the benefit of that versus coming to me is it's closer, so they don't have to get accommodation. They can still live at my house. As you remember, Santa Cruz is over a mountain range. So even though it's only 45 minutes away, that drive can be very terrible depending
On a
on weather.
rainy night.
Yes. And there's no way that the residents could take call from home. They'd have to live down where I am. But no, it's absolutely come up various times. I've had medical students come and shadow me in the clinic, but I haven't actually had trainees in the OR. But you're right. I think one thing I'm excited about is actually our hospital, not through Stanford, is getting a family medicine rotation residency program starting. And I think even family medicine residents, can, get something out of rotating through aspects of
Oh,
neurosurgery.
sure.
So I think there's probably definitely, especially if we continue to grow with more of a footprint in some other hospitals, maybe some of the other trauma hospitals, there might even be more of a learning experience for them.
So, we recently on the podcast spoke with someone who is the head of a group like of 30 neurosurgeons, and now you've got three of you down there. What kind of hurdles or pitfalls did you have trying to start up the management aspect of this, the practice management? Did you get any help from your hospital?
Yeah, we're continually working on that actually. I think yes, there is some cost sharing and contracting with Dominican Hospital to help with, medical directorship and those sorts of things. And they have, again, that's an area where I used to sort of just let Stanford deal with it and say, okay, let the business people deal with it. But I actually started taking some business courses and getting interested in that a little bit and taking some leadership courses because I think, most of us neurosurgeons know, if you want to fix something, you sort of have to figure it out yourself. And I think that that's kind of the way I'm sort of looking at it now as a bit of a project to work on improving that cost sharing because the big issue that we face is resources. Because as you can imagine, Stanford isn't going to give me unlimited MAs and APPs and things like that, because a lot of the money that I make goes to the hospital that I'm working at, not to Stanford mothership. So then there has to be a good appropriate cost sharing model so that I can get the resources I need. And like, for instance, when I first started, I was taking, Q2 call. I was dumb
Ouch.
to do that for 6 years. And then I started saying, Hey, you start to realize your value to this hospital. And that if you decide to say, Hey, I'm putting my hands up and not doing this much call, if they have uncovered nights, that's a huge cost to that hospital. And you have to figure out your value in that regard because everything, every little ditzel of blood or stable neck fracture that you see would have to transfer. And that's a huge cost to the hospital. So I think we're continually working on that in terms of finding that right balance of resources. And so that's what's hard with these unique models is you have to figure it out because there's no sort of template for you to follow. And when you're really small, you can do it. But if you want to start to try to grow, there's those growing pains with trying to get the hospitals that you're providing these services for to realize your value and what it would and also realize like, okay, you're getting a Stanford neurosurgeon and access to a lot of the things that Stanford has versus a doc in the box type things that are starting to grow for neurosurgery. Like we have them here in our community for some other specialties like ER and other things, these big groups. They're just, doctors come in from wherever. And I think that the community doesn't want that. They want a neurosurgeon that they know, that they have the cell phone, that they know where they live, they can go to their holiday party. They want you to be part, they want their surgeons to be part of their community. So I think it's let's say it's a work in progress. I'm still working on it.
Well, it sounds like a really attractive opportunity for a young neurosurgeon. Many of the people who listen to this podcast are younger neurosurgeons looking for, early in their career, looking for different sort of job opportunities. And typically, what they think when they get through residency is, oh, I got to work in an academic institution or I'm going to be in a strictly private practice. And this is kind of like, in some sense, the best of both worlds.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think there's obviously, from a financial point of view, you can like a lot of things, I mean, you can make as much money as you want, in the sense that if you want to work really hard and do a lot of cases and take a lot of call,
Yeah.
You know, you can do, you know, so you have to find that work, you know, there's a little bit more, I think, opportunity for you to sort of decide, versus if you're just in sort of a very strict academic model, it kind of is what it is to a certain extent, you know, this you can really make it what you want to make it, depending, you know, so I think you have to, be of the private practice mentality. You know, they teach you, you know, affable, available, like, you know, you can't be sitting in your ivory tower, you know, being cranky on the phone with people and not responding to messages and not answering your phone. Like, you really have to be available to your community. That part of it's private practice. Like,
I spent a lot of time in private practice, and I always tell my residents that I get really upset when I see on the H&P, you know, outside physician or outside hospital. It's like, that physician has a name, that hospital has a name, and they'd be very upset to see the H&P or the discharge summary come back to them and the, you know, LMD, you know, that took care of the patient. So you go to lunch with these doctors, you know, in the doctor's lounge, you know them, and they've got your cell phone number, like you say. And so I'm sure they appreciate that. That's the big thing they hear about academic centers. They never get any feedback, you know, don't know how their patients are doing. So being there, living with these physicians in their community, I'm sure it's a really rewarding experience.
It is. And I mean, you really, you take care of your community. I mean, I've taken care of so many people's family members, you know, surfing accidents of kids that, you know, bad subdurals, like, you know, that you really, once you sort of do those kinds of cases on, you know, members of your community or of your physician community, I mean, there's a lot, like, they will stand in traffic for you, you know, they will do anything, really help you succeed and you know, do whatever they can to help you in those kinds of situations, when you've really kind of dedicated yourself to being available to your community for stuff like that. So,
Your hospital must have figured out that being without a neurosurgeon, they were losing, you know, they needed that they benefit from having you there and your partners.
Yeah. I mean, as you know, in the Bay Area, there's a lot of hospitals, there's a lot of neurosurgeons, there's a lot of doctors, but we are a bit isolated here in Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. And there are actually not infrequent, like, we're having you can't maybe see from where you are, but there's, you know, we're having some wet weather right now. Mm-hmm. And that highway will close and you can't fly here. Helicopters won't land. And so again, there's been lots of times I've had to operate on babies or kids.
Oh my goodness.
It's more than I would like to remember over the last 11 years of practice, almost 12 years of practice, you know, because but the benefit of that is that I still have Stanford so close by, that Jerry Grant, who, you know, I know, you know, great friend, great colleague. You know, one day I had to do an epidural on a baby in a circumstance like this, where there was bad weather and they couldn't fly. And, you know, I called him and I said, okay, like, I think I'm going to be okay with the surgery part, but I mean, remind me, like, I know, like, what am I going to have to tell anesthesia? You know, and what am I going to have to do for blood? And, you know, I mean, like, the our part's not the hard part a lot of the time. Right. Mm-hmm. So but I had him on the phone with me, and like, we talked it through with anesthesia, and, you know, I used what I could in my OR. I didn't have, you know, like the absorbable plates and all that stuff. And he told me what to do instead. And, you know, we all have the skills to do that kind of thing. But I think, you know, the fact that I could call him and talk to him and knew him and we had that connection meant that he didn't get like a dead baby, which they get all the time, because there's not those relationships with the academic center where the doctor in the community feels comfortable, doesn't feel comfortable doing the case, but also doesn't feel comfortable maybe, hey, maybe if I just call that pediatric surgeon that I'm sending this to and have a conversation, I might be able to make it work down here and not send them a dead baby, you know? So I think it's been great. I think I love having, you know, I call them all the time, you know, all my colleagues there in tumor and spine. Mm-hmm. So I still feel connected to the department. If I take out a tumor, I present it at our tumor board and I get the recommendations and the benefit of, you know, all those great people in neuro-oncology. So it's for me, it's been great. I mean, again, I think it's obviously unique and it's not for everybody. You have to work really hard from a hours point of view, I guess, in a different kind of way than people have labs, and it's a different kind of work, I guess.
Sure. So, you know, that was another question I was going to have. As you mentioned your family earlier when we were talking off mic, how do you manage that? How do you balance all of that in a relatively small practice in a community like that?
Yeah, I do think that the benefit of being here, like I told you before, and putting that goodwill in the bank has helped me. For instance, like I'm not a trauma center, so I think that makes a big deal. When I first came, we would get a lot of trauma just because the systems of where trauma would go weren't super clear, and we'd just get a lot of walk-in trauma and ambulances with trauma. We weren't set up for it. We don't have a general surgery kind of system for it. So that has improved. So I don't get a lot of trauma. So our call, although I take a lot of call, it's it's busy, but it's not terrible, life and death all the time. I mean, acute subdural can always happen. But I think that, for instance, if I get a call from the emergency room and I'm putting my kid to bed, I know the girl, her name's Lindsay, and she works in the EED at night. And she's like, "Hi, Dr. Herr, I know it's always 7 or 8 o'clock when I call you." And I'm like, "Yeah." She's like, and she'll be like, "Look, this isn't something that you need. If you're putting the kids to bed, just call back in like a half an hour, Dr. Dr. So-and-so, it doesn't need you right away, but there's this person here with, you know, I don't know, a compression fracture or something." And so I think that's one way, is that they don't call me that much, for instance, between, you know, 4 and 6, or, you know, 3 and 6, unless someone is really dying. They'll be like, "Look, this person came in a few hours ago. I didn't want to wake you. It wasn't urgent."
Because they know you, you know.
And they know I'm going to be operating the whole day. And they know that I'm going to be there the whole day. So, so I think that has helped. I also have a great husband who from the very beginning of my residency, when we started dating, in second year residency, we met, sort of really decided that he was going to be there to support me with my career and with us having kids, because I wasn't sure that I thought I could make it work. I mean, I'm 45. And so even when I started, there was no women in my program that were having kids, or there was no, wow. I trained, though I just had our first female attending, had just started. I had no other female residents at that time. It's really different now, you know, and there would have been no way I would have had a baby during residency. Like, that just would have been like unheard of. But I think that those things are changing now. But my husband sort of was pre that change, and he accepted that he was going to be the person to be there for the kids a lot. And we made that decision, if we were going to have kids, that someone was going to be there. And a lot of the time it was going to have to be him. So, so I think having a partner who's supportive has been really helpful, and also help. I mean, I have, you know, I delegate things that are low yield a lot. You know, I have some, you know, I pay for people to clean my house, and I pay for people to do a lot of things. You know, my husband's a chef, helps. My husband's a chef, so I don't have to worry about cooking. And
that's cool. Nice. Yeah.
And for a long time, we had help with the kids. I mean, we had au pairs that would come and live with us, young girls from different countries, which was a great experience. And my kids learned different languages and things. I think having help, and having good colleagues and Stanford's been very supportive too. And my colleagues at Stanford are very supportive. So I think that's been helpful.
So other than walking on the boardwalk, what do you do for fun in Santa Cruz?
Oh, well, there's so much to do. Yeah. I'm a mountain biker. So I love to mountain bike. So my husband and I, that's like our love, is biking. That's how we ended up in California, to be honest, was meeting people on a bike trip, and one thing led to another. So biking, I would say. I would go to the beach a lot. My husband just brought the dogs back from the beach. So there's a lot of beach activity. I'm not a surfer, but I like to swim in the ocean. And then we actually we're both skiers, being from Canada. My husband's a very good skier. I'm borderline okay. But we have a partial ownership at a place up in Tahoe, and 3 hours a day. So we try to go up there when we can and get to the snow. They're getting a dump this weekend because it's storming. So 5 feet of snow or something are coming to Tahoe this weekend. So we ski as well, if we can, if we can get up there. I'd say that. And then I'm part of the community. I'm on the board of a classical contemporary music festival called Cabrillo Contemporary Music Festival, which is sort of an international classical music festival. And I'm involved in this ballet community because my daughter's very involved in ballet, and there's a pretty good ballet company here in Santa Cruz. So I stay involved with the community. It's a great community.
Sounds great. Last question that I usually ask people, and that is, Stanford Cardinal or the Rams? I had to look that one up.
Yeah, definitely a cardinal, I'd have to say. I've been here long enough. My husband, my family back home may not love that, but yeah, definitely
a cardinal. The Dalhousie Rams, right?
Yes. Yeah. I never would, you know, football is not a big thing in Canada, as you know, like it is here. You'd have to give me a hockey analogy. A Leaf, if you were going to give me
a Leaf. Yeah. Then what would you say?
And the San Jose Sharks, I'd have to say Leafs.
Leafs versus the Sharks. Yes, all right.
Yeah, that would definitely be my team, even though they are terrible most of the time. But
well, thank you so much, Kira, for joining us today, Dr. Kira Haraher from Stanford University. We really appreciate you being a part of the AANS podcast.
Thanks, Paul. I've really enjoyed chatting with you.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for listening again to another in our series of the practice management concepts. What are they and why should you care on the AANS Practice and Business Management Podcast? Stay tuned for our next episode next week.